I am Niels Bentilen. I'm the chief ML engineer at Union AI, and I take my coffee. I make an espresso every morning with some soy, basically a soy latte. So it's good.
Welcome back, everyone. This is the MLOps Community Podcast. I am your host, Dimitri Ose, and today we've got such a wonderful conversation. This conversation is for those real machine learning engineers, the people that have been sick of me talking about LLMs for the past 6 months. This is the conversation for you. Real MLOps is to be heard in the chat with Niels. And what a chat it was, my Lord. He is such an awesome human being. I appreciate chatting with him every time we get together. I mean, we did the engineering labs, aka hackathons, last year with Union, and Niels was the leader of that whole thing, and it was a ton of fun. But in today's conversation, we talked through his creation of Pandera, a data quality tool that he has since, spoiler alert, merged with Flyte. We also got into using machine learning at the infrastructure layer. So not like talking about text to Terraform with LLMs, more talking about predictive analytics and predictive machine learning when it comes to running your machine learning workloads. So got a little meta in there. And then we slowly slithered on down and we had to chat a little bit about the LLM sphere and what's going on with the OpenAI day that just happened. And later on, we talked all about how he looks at these different maturity levels and how he thinks about data lineage and really reproducibility when it comes to ML. And last but not least, I loved that he talked to me about how he sees the ML stack and how it will compare to the LLM stack and how he feels that there still needs to be this whole machine learning stack that probably in his eyes is a bit under, it's like a little bit further down than what you get when you're just using an API from OpenAI. It's like, what is OpenAI using? That is the ML stack that we talked about today. Not what are the people that are building on OpenAI's API. No. What is OpenAI using, or what are other companies that are doing machine learning using? And not getting caught up in the hype one bit. Niels was incredible. I loved chatting with him. I hope you do too. And for everyone that does not know Niels, because you did not take part in our virtual hackathon last year, his mission is to help data scientists and machine learning practitioners be more productive. So that's why we got him on here, man. He's doing work with Union at the moment. You've probably heard the conversation that we had with Kaitan, the CEO of Union. And if you have not, I would highly encourage you to go check that out right now. We'll leave a link in the description. Last but not least, a huge shout out to Union because they have been sponsors of the community since like 2020. I gotta send some love their way. It is incredible to see how much they're growing and how much love they're giving us. So right back at you, Union. Thank you for all your support. If anyone is looking for some orchestration layer tooling, go check out Flyte. You can get that open source. They've got an awesome community around it. Or if you just want to go and give them your money right away, check out Union. That's it. I'll see you all in a bit. Dude, I think we got to start with Pandera. What is that and what happened? What's the story there, man? Give us the background on it.
Yeah, let's do it. Pandera was one of those projects that I sort of didn't expect would gain any traction whatsoever. It was, you know, it's not the most popular thing, but in terms of like within the scope of the project, it's, you know, pretty well used and well known at this point, but it really literally was scratching my own itch. I was working with data frames a lot, pandas, you know, I wasn't doing anything super big with data set size wise, but encountered all sorts of data type errors, date time formatting, negative numbers where there shouldn't be, null values where there shouldn't be. So because pandas and other data frames, right, now it's kind of changing a little bit with polars, but more on that later. But yeah, with pandas, it's powerful. It's dynamic, dynamically typed, and it does some surprising things sometimes when you have like a long chain of transformations and that you can easily get lost and not know what the data looks like anymore. And Pandera was this tool I built for myself to just help with that. So I can, in my code, I can just see, okay, there's a function that outputs a data frame that follows this schema. And I was like, okay, what does the schema look like? Now I could just go to the schema definition. I can see here are the column names, here are the data types. These are the kind of check kind of constraints, you know, range values and things like this. So I can just see it at a glance. And before that, I would have to load the data into memory, do some profiling, just like do a dot describe and, you know, use pandas profiling and all this
stuff. Yeah, cumbersome.
Like, you know, which I think is still a useful activity. You still need to like grok your data somehow to write the schema in the first place. But it's just a way for you to encode that and then put it in your code base.
Dude, so it's so cool because it's one of those things that you probably were like, all right, this is mine. I'm just going to, you know, put it out there in case one or two other people feel like they would find use in it. And then all of a sudden it kind of, I mean, relatively blows up, right?
Yeah, slow. Yeah, I would say modestly slow growth, right? Over the span of what it's been five, six years now. And like every time I go to a conference to talk about it, there's like a little bump and then it kind of flattens out and it goes to like the kind of ambient organic growth and then another conference and then another conference. So kind of the story, I'm still working on the story, to be honest. It's like, sure, it's the core is data validation, but now the scope has sort of expanded. And now we're working on a Polars integration. I worked with the Quantum Black team at McKinsey to implement a PySpark integration. So that's out. That took like 2 months.
But to be clear, this is not your day job. You are not getting paid. This is full moonlighting, right? And you never thought about creating a company out of this?
I did. And we actually, so maybe a slight correction is that I merged Pandera into Union.
Oh, okay.
So that's fairly recent news. We didn't make too big of a deal out of it. But to answer your question, yeah, that was on my mind even when I joined Union was, okay, I have this project. And the company building thing came across my mind, but whichever way, like I didn't want to go through the VC route and not have a clear business model, right? So I wanted to kind of think through it and every which way I would think of it. And having talked to some customers, users, I guess, but I would say a customer would be someone using it in production at a company, right? Not like a hobbyist. Like I would talk to them and I would ask, you know, so what, like I have XYZ ideas to productize this, monetize this. And every single time I heard, like, I don't want you to touch my data. You know, I want Pandera in my cloud generating error messages and error reports that I control. And like, okay, maybe we can send you some metadata and you can visualize it. And I'm like, okay, it's an interesting platform idea, but generating reports is not, that didn't seem like a fun thing for me to build, right? like creating a web UI with like visualizations on error reports, like code cov, you know, for data, right?
Not what you were putting on, not what you were put on this earth to do, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it just wasn't exciting to me. So every which way I thought of it, like the cool stuff that I wanted to do was a kind of tracking data quality over time for like a specific data set. And like the only way really to do this effectively is if you have a product that people install, hint, hint, flight, right? That people install on their cloud that they own, that they feel secure about, and you generate these reports that you can then, you know, as you're collecting data shift or like how your data evolves over time and like the nature of your errors, you can sort of like take that and do some more useful things with it, you know? So you can think of like, yeah, data set shift, things like problems like this. So it just seemed like I talked to Ketan, you know, and basically we merged Pandera into Union like earlier this year, maybe end of last year. But so now it's kind of my full-time job now, but I'm still sort of like one of the sole maintainers of it. So, you know, we're ramping up, we're a startup. We're going to invest more in it very, very soon, actually. But right now it's me working with like our open source contributors.
You were acqui-hired, but
exactly.
Pre-acqui-hired, yeah. You were already working for them.
Yeah.
Then you just figured out a way to make that work. And that's so cool. Talk to me about the integration with Polaris. Or Polar, sorry.
Polaris, yeah, yeah.
I put a little bit of a French twang Polaris on it right there. Yeah. Did you see that?
It's a cool method.
You know, Polaris, no. Yeah, talk to me about the integration with Polaris.
So that's just started. There's a lot of interest in the community. I think it's the issue with the most thumbs up right now.
Yeah.
So the way this has worked in the past is either I've gotten the ball rolling and then I kind of like gather a team of interested people and then they'll work on it. So that's how this is turning out. Other times, like some person, like the kind of Pydantic style syntax with data frame model, that was completely done by someone. And, you know, he just, Jeff Zank, I have to give him credit each time because he was like the first major contributor to the project, one of the first. So yeah, just for the Polaris integration, it's really fun. I hadn't actually used Polaris, but I just kind of seen it. I saw like the performance, you know, differences and like the syntax looked pretty cool. So when I started playing around with the integration, it's an interesting programming model that's substantially different from pandas in a way, but it's familiar enough where I think a pandas user can kind of hop in, learn a few new abstractions like lazy evaluation, you know. The lazy frame is super powerful. So
what is that exactly?
So unlike a data frame, you say, you know, pandas.dataframe.assign x equals 2, and you get a new column, x equals 2. Like, and when you execute that code, it's going to add the new column. But with lazy frames, it's essentially you're building like a graph of transformations that aren't evaluated immediately. But when you call dataframe.collect, it actually compiles your transformations and makes it more efficient, which is one of the reasons why Polaris is like much more performant in many cases.
What a great name too. It makes total sense. After you explained it, it's like, of course, the lazy
frame. Yeah.
Dude, there is something that I wanted to mention going back to this data quality piece and tracking it over time. And something that we were talking about before we hit record was like, oh man, isn't there ways that we can start injecting ML into our infrastructure? And it feels like if you have this data on how your data is changing and transforming or the errors that you're getting over time, that gives you a bit more to play with on on your side. And maybe it's, I don't know whose job it would be, if it's like you as Pandera / Flight are going to take on this challenge, or if it should be us as the users that have all this data and we're going to take on this challenge, to just have it be more like we can do cool stuff with this extra data that we're getting. Because now we have, over time, we're able to see what's going on, and then maybe we can figure out a way to leverage that.
Yeah, I think in terms of responsibility, it is on the orchestrator layer to collect that data in some structured way, semi-structured way that, again, I don't know. It'll probably be kind of like a plugin or some kind of side thing that the orchestrator does to take that patterns and that data. For example, like this particular workflow tends to error out a lot with particular sets of inputs or data set sizes. Or this other one like has these weird kind of memory spikes, right? And you don't really, maybe in those simple cases, need ML to really surface that. This is like an analytics thing. You like collect it, you apply some set of like deterministic rules on it, and then you surface that to the user. So I think that's probably kind of like MVP for this kind of abstraction on top of an orchestrator to give the user of that orchestrator a lot more visibility into what's happening. But I can imagine, you know, much more complex things that, you know, you want to summarize errors, you want to do other things, and surface patterns that are not easily captured with kind of if-else statements.
Uh-huh.
In that case, I think the first step is just to collect the data. And then there's a ton of research, I think. I don't know. This is not really the shiniest or sexiest thing, maybe. I don't know if people are going to work on it, but if there is a business value to it, i.e. like less cost or, you know, some kind of savings, then there should be enough incentive for like Union or another company similar to it to work on it.
Well, I guess at the end of the day, it's like, if you can better predict the future on the jobs or the workloads that you're about to run, that has a benefit, right? And there's some value in that if you can save yourself time in any way possible, because those, especially if you're starting to deal with GPUs, it could be quite costly if all of a sudden you're not saturating the GPUs like you want to, and you didn't realize that beforehand, and so now all of a sudden your job is not being fully utilized. It would be great to know that, like, before I queue that up, that's about to happen, and you get those warning messages like, hey, by the way, we've seen stuff like this in the past from you, and it didn't turn out too hot. Or your friend over here has been doing this all afternoon, and it's just not working for him. Or whatever it may be, figuring out how to better predict the future in a way. And that's why it's funny, because when we were talking about it, and you were like, yeah, how to inject ML into these different infrastructure problems, or just into the infrastructure layer, I was like, what do you mean, like text to infrastructure? And it's like, no, even cooler than that would be the same way that you predict, or that you can try and predict what someone will like when they buy 5 items on Amazon, or when they watch 5 movies on Netflix. Can you predict what will happen next if you have all this information and all this data about the workloads that they're running?
Yeah, exactly. The current state of things is that it's kind of, you know, you lick your finger and put it to the wind, and you're like, okay, what do I need in terms of resources for like a gig of data with a 1 billion parameter model or something? Like, you can do some back of the envelope calculations of what exactly you'll need, but the rubber meets the road when you have to execute it. You have to know if it fails or succeeds. And this is kind of like a reinforcement learning signal, right? It's like you have a binary success failure signal. you have some inputs, and you know, you have a pretty structured data, pretty structured kind of grammar for how you specify the resources, et cetera, et cetera. Not suggesting you apply RL to this, right? But I'm just saying, like, it's classification, the simpler framing of it. But this is something that we're interested in because for on the flight, and more, I guess, specifically in the union side, we have built these tools for you to visualize utilization. You can set your limits and quotas, and we kind of show, okay, here's your quota, here's what you're using, you know, like you could stand to increase, you know, your batch size, for example. But that, from a practitioner perspective, it's like, I just have to push the button, I have to like run the thing, fiddle around with it, and then see what works. So once you have enough users and you have enough scale to be able to say, to collect all of this, these mappings from like workflow code, resource specifications, to whether it succeeded or failed on a particular set of hardware, then you can start doing some interesting, at least at the research level, seeing if there are any patterns there at all. And I'm guessing there will be. I mean, it's pretty obvious to me. Like, if you have a string in your code that says code llama 7 billion, well, your model, if it's been trained on enough data, it should be able to say, okay, so I see a 7 billion thing there. Like, I'm going to need at least 7 billion, you know, like worth of memory, and that should map onto some specific hardware, et cetera, et cetera. We're not there yet, obviously, but that's something we're thinking about, that I'm thinking about, and you know, we're collecting like everything in from a metadata layer. So we won't necessarily have access to the code of, you know, users or customers, but it is an interesting application area that I don't read about that much.
And it feels like your feet are on the ground, because a lot of times I think you get people on Twitter or people that have become influencers talking about how AI is going to change everything. And this is just the start, but it's like, okay, here's an actual like real use case that could be quite useful, or maybe not. I think that's the fun part, is like, let's go validate if A, this is possible, which it seems like it is, just back of the napkin type thing. And then B, if it actually adds that much value to where people are like, oh my God, we need this, right? And so I think the interesting piece is, yeah, how you do it, how you make sure to get all the information you need, but you're mentioning like, all right, we're not going to have access to a lot of this stuff. So then it becomes an even harder problem, I would imagine, from your side. Like, you got to kind of guesstimate things or just fill in the blank?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably from a features perspective, probably the most important thing, if we're thinking just ML workloads or maybe data workloads, is data set size and model size. I imagine that'll kind of be the bulk of the predictive power, and then there'll be some other features there that would at kind of the margins adjust what the predictions are. But yeah, I know stories from people who worked at Meta, their internal platform, FB Learner, had features like this, right? But it was more algorithmic. It was like, try this, and then if that fails, double it. And if that succeeds, like,
cut it in half.
You know, cut it by 75%. And if that fails, like, increase it slightly, you know? So, that it may turn out that's the best we got.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. I mean, ML is all about empiricism, right? It's like, you just got to try it.
Yeah, totally. It is funny, because it's like, man, like you were saying, it's not the sexiest of things, but I'm having a great time nerding out about this, because it's like, whoa, that's a totally open area. And it feels like that can definitely happen. It's not like it's out of our grasp or our abilities right now, right? I think if you're telling me, or if you're talking to me more about like, this idea that I was telling you, like the text to infra, which I know there are people that are like generative DevOps.
Yeah.
There's a whole generative DevOps movement. Have you explored that corner of the internet at all?
Not deeply. I've seen the term, and I've seen like this kind of the demo of, you say, I want such and such infrastructure, and it like generates a Terraform file or something. And it makes sense. Like, that application does make sense to me, I think. So yeah, I'm curious to see where that goes.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's one, though, that I'm much more skeptical of, I guess, just by nature, because of the times that I struggle just with ChatGPT in English, right? And English is, it was trained way more on English, I get the feeling, than on Terraform. And so I wonder how well that does, and if it doesn't just end up causing more headaches than it's worth, right? Like, you're like, yeah, check out this cool thing. I can just like talk to it and then it'll give me Terraform. And you end up talking to it in all this like code. It's like half English, half code type things that you have to know to specify this and that. And at the end of the day, you're like, wouldn't it just be easier to get a really good plugin on Vim and do it yourself?
Yeah. I think it's the sign of a boom in a space when you just try everything on it, and then in three to five years we'll have like a much smaller set of things that turned out to be useful.
Yeah.
DevOps, LLM, kind of generative DevOps is interesting, but as you point out, it's the risk there is like complacency almost. I mean, I think of Dune, right? Like the story of the thinking machines and how there is like this whole war kind of like between humans and machines, not in the Terminator sense, right? But it's like in the original books, it was about how we outsourced reasoning to these thinking machines. And that's why I'm not anti these new developments, but I think there's something to, things get normalized and we get lazy, and I will just accept a generated piece of code. Maybe not me, because like I'll look over it, but I can see myself if I use it enough and it's like accurate enough that like I'll just completely outsource my judgment to this thing. And even though like the creators of it are like, oh, always put your wheel on the car, right? So it's like, always read your code, but that's not how humans work. And so, yeah, it's a kind of a balance of, you know, leveraging it for useful things and then design. Like, how are we designing these things so that we mitigate the risk in this case of, you know, outsourcing judgment and reasoning?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically pushing it to the limit. Like, how much can I do this until it comes back and bites me in the ass?
Yep.
I'm going to keep accepting these suggestions until then, like, I just shipped that to prod and nobody caught that there was this huge vulnerability, or nobody noticed that, like, I crashed everything.
Yeah, and the thing that concerns me, too, is the way people are thinking these days. I'm sure this is not everyone, but like a thread that I've been seeing is like, oh, LLMs have introduced some new problems. Well, let's solve that with LLMs, right? So like, let's have a review bot. So let's have a bot that writes the code, and then we'll have another bot that's specially trained to review that code. But there's this infinite regress to,
sure,
like at the end of the day, you either have a kind of like a person behind the curtain, kind of like needing to vet these things, or you just completely let it run and see what happens, which that's not, I don't see that being a pattern for serious companies anytime soon.
It's funny too, that idea just always reminds me of the exhibit meme Like, yo, dog, I heard you like cars.
Yeah.
So we put a car in your car. It's like, I heard you like LLM. So we made an LLM that reviews your LLMs on your LLM. So, it's so good. But dude, I mean, not to get too caught up in the LLM hype, but I know that yesterday it was basically every LLM lover's dream because OpenAI had their dev day. And so how do you feel like what you're doing right now and the work you're doing in the orchestration layer like fits into all of this with the stuff that just came out yesterday? And we'll timestamp this as we're recording it on November 7th, right? So a day after Dev Day.
Yep. Yeah, I reviewed sort of the presentation when it was released. I think in the context of my work and the work at Union, in a way, I think it's sort of orthogonal. Like the people we talk to, they are not generating tokens. They are processing video for a very specific use case that maybe in 100 years, 50 years, 25 years, LLM can kind of code those problems. But I think still there will be a, you know, software 1.0 layer, right? That is like the deterministic stuff, like the good stuff of like just good old programming that just like works and it's idempotent if you want it to be idempotent. And it's like, you know, so there's this fundamental layer that I see myself kind of operating in.
This is Skylar. I lead machine learning at Health Rhythms. If you want to stay on top of everything happening in MLOps, subscribe to this podcast now. 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 Now.
And from my perspective, the OpenAI Dev Day was sort of like, to make an analogy, it's like the App Store with the iPhone, right? It's like, here's like software, I don't know how many .0s it is, but it's like, here's this like new compute platform that operates on tokens, and the LLM is like a virtual machine that you give it tokens, and if it can understand those tokens, it'll spit out some more tokens, right? And those can be instructions that are function calls to other things. You know, so it's a very interesting like paradigm. But I think for the foreseeable future, there will still be people making survival models, people training models on tabular data, computer vision, like image and video data, audio data, like text data, where all you need is like a sentiment prediction or something. And maybe you can use LLM for that, but you know, they are building kind of these bespoke systems that maybe speaking too soon here, but yeah, I think for the foreseeable future, you will still kind of need this. You'll still need humans in this kind of like lower layer where you're not like delegating a lot of the work to a machine learning model. Because that's kind of the thesis, right? It's like with a powerful enough LLM, you can have it code, you can have it be your CEO, you can have it do everything, right? But that's kind of the vision they're selling, which is interesting. I think people will create a lot of interesting applications on top of it. But in the context of my work, it's, as I said, orthogonal. I think like there is still the question of open source versus closed. And like, I think their narrative is a lot more centered on this kind of AGI vision and things like this, whereas I prefer to work in this less speculative space. And that kind of means, hey, what does a customer need today or in a week?
Yeah, I think that's why we get along so well, man. Sometimes when I hear people talk and say the word AGI, I kind of mini vomit in my mouth. It's like, get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, so it's... But at the end of the day, they're like using Ray, right? So, you know,
yeah.
I guess shout out to Ray. But like OpenAI is still using the tech stack that we all know and love to build their stuff, you know, so
their AGI.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true.
Then AGI will know NumPy and like love NumPy because that's like the ancestor of its whatever lineage.
That's so funny. AGI will run on Quadrant and Ray. And so if you ever want to fuck with it, just merge some bugs into those open source projects. That's so funny. And I mean, that is true. It's like there is this base layer. You go a little bit deeper down the stack almost. Just like when we were talking MLOps from like 2020 to 2023 before the boom, there was this stack and this life cycle that machine learning played in, right? But then you could go down the stack a little bit more and all of a sudden you're encountering Kubernetes and you're encountering, hey, how are we networking these nodes and what are we doing? And it's more like the SRE DevOps type persona.
Yep.
That interfaces with the ML engineer, but they're not, it's orthogonal, right? It's a little bit further down the stack. And then you can even continue down the stack, right? And as far as you want. But the piece there is, yeah, you almost threw something on top, which now has its own stack almost. Now, when people interface with LLMs, there's a LLM stack that you have. And under those LLMs there's still a whole stack to be utilized and used there. And so I wonder about how the separation there then becomes, because like the orchestration layer for what you're doing is one thing, and I imagine you're still encountering LLMs on the daily basis, right? Like people are, maybe it's open source, maybe, I would imagine, yeah, a lot of open source, if they're using Flyte and they're adding it as part of these different workflows or what they're doing. Like, how does that look? Because you have a stack that is the LLM, LLM ops stack, but then you also have these MLOp workloads or the orchestration that you're doing.
Yeah, so I'm kind of, I've drank the Kool-Aid, basically the Flyte kind of philosophy that when it comes to machine learning models and LLMs are just quote unquote ML models, right? AI is kind of like a branding kind of thing as far as I'm concerned. But ML models, it's like a trifecta of model architecture, data set, and infrastructure. Right. And I think the evolution of this space, infrastructure was less kind of emphasized. And I'm sure there are organizations where it was, but like, at least from my perspective, right, you start with, it runs on my laptop. We're not training billion parameter models. It's like, here's sklearn, XGBoost, here's some tables. I'm just going to train on it and it works on my laptop, right?
Yeah, so they explore.
There's like, and it'll work on pretty much everyone's laptop except for the times where your virtual environments don't sync up, hence the tooling around, you know. So we're already getting into the infrastructure a little bit where like the whole it works on my laptop meme kind of came from. But as we're scaling the models, as we're scaling the data sets, now infrastructure in this trifecta is becoming more and more important. And I remember the first time I encountered infrastructure as code, like Terraform or like AWS CloudFormation, it was pretty cool because all I do is write some JSON or YAML, and there are problems there, I guess, as well. But like, it's declarative. I say what I want, and like, there is a process that figures out how to like do all these things with what I've declared. So, you know, life is good when you're an ML engineer at a fairly new kind of ML practice at an organization. You like do a query, SQL query. Now you have your little data set, you play around with it. Okay, it looks pretty good on the test set. So then you like spin up a little Flask or Fast API server, and then that's how you deploy it. But at some point, you will encounter all of these issues. And that's what these point solutions are now, like, you know, experiment tracking, weights and biases, MLflow, scalable data transformations, like you have Dask, Ray, PySpark. You have experiment tracking, model observability, data quality. But how do you like put all these things together? And that's where an orchestration layer is really helpful. Even I would say with LLM ops, it adds a few more pieces to like the software kind of system, but it's fundamentally like you're adding some information retrieval with RAG. You're adding a few little pieces that we actually know pretty well, and these are pretty mature spaces. But now you just, you know, think about vectors and, you know, cosine similarity or other kind of like distance metrics instead of like, I don't know, keyword matching or key phrase matching. So there's like a different spin on it, but at the end of the day, then this is what we're seeing is the more and more mature an organization is and more pain points they've felt in this journey, it correlates positively with their uptake of Flyte. Because they're like, Kubernetes, okay, it's like maybe not the easiest thing to work with unless you're like an expert, but like I'm going to invest because I can see the value of lineage and reproducibility. So I think LLM ops specifically will undergo similar sort of growing pains, because right now it's like pretty Wild West and sort of the standards are being created and you were borrowing from different spaces, but I don't think these kind of production requirements will go away, like reproducibility, for example, or resource kind of isolation and, you know, things like this.
It is a fascinating one to think about reproducibility when it comes to using these LLMs, because that is basically all thrown out the window.
Yeah, exactly. I think, interestingly enough, they did show in the dev day yesterday, what is it? Like, you can pass in a seed parameter now. So, you know, you do get some item potency there. But it kind of like case in point, right? There has been the demand to be like, hey, I want the same output if I gave it the same input.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it's funny too, like this idea that you're talking about on how the companies that are the most mature, the ones that have been through and gotten their bruises and their scratches, they're like, okay, I see the value here and I understand, yeah, Kubernetes, like I'm probably on it and I understand the workload that it needs. And then Flyte, it gets me there because it has that bulletproofness and it has that, like, it's a workhorse and it will scale with me because I'm already at this certain scale. And you're not looking to the future of like this high flying, hey, are we going to have AI take over the world or it's going to take over our company? It's just like, no, I got to do this stuff. I said that I would complete this task by the end of this sprint, and so I need it done now. You know, I can't be spending time messing around with seed parameters and figuring out how I can reproduce this, right?
Yeah, exactly. There are the constraints, right, of time and resources, where in the longer time horizon, you know, maybe to play devil's advocate of my and maybe your general feeling is like, yes, long enough time horizon, we will have amazing things that will do things that we can't even imagine. But my time horizon is in a month. So like these sort of more aspirational visions are, I think, useful to have, but practicality and pragmatism kind of like is one of the values that I sort of have on top of or over things that kind of get me excited, you know, and it's important. I think you need a kind of a balance of inspiration and just like being real. Yeah, that's, I think, the thing that kind of confirms my stance on this is just like the open source flight users, the Union Cloud customers we're bringing on, they all have very thorny like workloads and very specific things that I don't think you can really automate. The things we can help with are all of the things that I just mentioned, right? Like your job is already complicated enough. I just want to make sure once I've gotten it a working state that it's going to work, you know, next year.
Yeah. What are some of these challenges that you're seeing?
I'm going to try to be careful here because we haven't really announced too much, but some of these challenges are around iteration speed and making it feel like as a data scientist or ML engineer, I can kind of seamlessly go from my local laptop to whatever resource that I want. Not like some opinionated platform, but could be Spark, could be Databricks, could be Ray, could be Union or a flight cluster, could be something else, right? So we are solving for these problems and trying to make Flight and FlightKit, the SDK, just more useful by itself, just to make it feel as if, hey, I'm on my laptop and whatever I can do on my laptop will run on it, but I can delegate to these other cloud, these other products as needed based on where my company is at and based on where my company's tooling and like what has been approved as like the approved vendor, right? So there are all these like real world constraints and at an organizational level that you may not want to buy into something too opinionated. And that's sort of like one of our operating philosophies is, yes, flight is opinionated, but there is escape hatches and things you can do to customize if you need like all these other kind of tools in your tool belt that you're already familiar with. So sorry if that's a little vague, but we are solving for this sort of like problem of scale and like developer experience where it feels like you're just working on your laptop.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's like this idea of not letting flight get in the way of you wanting to do something. Right now, I have access to A, B, and C resources. I'm going to leverage flight to do that, not like, flight only allows me to do A, but not B and C, right? Because it's so opinionated and it will only have that be my choice. And so you get those integrations and you get that flexibility. So that makes complete sense. I could see that.
Yeah, and a related problem is, you know, like say I'm iterating on something and I'm like kicking off all these executions on local and on flight as well. And I'm producing all these artifacts, right? So that's data, it's models, it's metadata.
Yeah.
And today, flight is good at encapsulating data lineage as like, okay, I have my workflow and I have all these nodes. And when I execute it, flight will keep track of that in that kind of workflow in isolation. But what if like this workflow produces a data set and then I have a completely separate workflow here that consumes it, right? And then produces a model. I don't want to like strongly couple those two, but I do want to track that artifact as it's traveling through the system in various different ways. So that's another problem we're solving for. We'll announce it when it's ready, but it's a pretty exciting development that's going to happen pretty soon. So,
well, it goes back to that reproducibility, and it's funny, man, because back like when I started this community, the company that I was working for was an MLOps company, right? And the main thing that we did was this reproducibility. So wherever your data was, wherever your code was, we were able to track it and make sure that whatever happened to the data, you knew exactly what was happening to it and where it came from and what it got partitioned into, whatever that may be. However it was molded, nobody fucking wanted it. the company went out of business. Shit.
Yeah.
That's why I'm doing the community.
Yeah.
That's the plot twist. So I hope, I think, and my theory is that A, it was way too early, right? Like this was 2019 that we were trying to sell this product to people, and people had a lot bigger issues in 2019 when they were trying to do machine learning. And then B, even if you did have people that were at the stage that they were ready for it, they probably had been building their own tool, or they were just big enough to where it was like, the maturity wasn't there, you know, like they didn't care that much about it because they hadn't felt these pains of years of pain. It's yep. like maybe they had just gotten to that maturity level, and so they kind of didn't know that it was actually a pain. And now we're, whatever, 3 years later, almost 4 years later, people are probably waking up to the fact that, like, oh, it doesn't need to be like this.
Yeah. No, I totally understand that kind of story and journey of, you know, the people you were, you know, selling to, people you were talking with. And it's unfortunate, right? Because the first and foremost, the thing that people want is for their system to work. Like, I just want it to work. I don't care. I'll just pile on the tech debt. I'll just like use my tech debt credit card as much as I can to even get something that, for, you know, ideally provides business value, or less ideally, like, gets your leadership team excited and executives and investors kind of hyped up, right? That's kind of like less of a ideal case, but, you know, whatever, like political acceptance and like, you know, like there is the that angle to machine learning where if you're not an ML first company, it's like, oh, you have to prove yourself, right? So like to prove yourself, you need to get that working model that whatever metric you choose, like, works, right? It's successful. And then you think about all these things like, oh, I have a massive, like, credit card debt here, and I need to fix it. And whatever platform and tech stack you choose to end that first phase of your journey, that you're kind of like, you're either stuck with it unless that platform adds these features, or you have to migrate, right? And so that's, it's sort of, this is one of my big learnings sort of like over the past, 3 years, is like, there's this longer time horizon process of what I just described, right? Whenever I talk to someone new now, this like, I should like make a blog post on this or whatever, but like, it should be like
please.
A map, right? And you should be able to like pinpoint, yeah, this person is right here. You know, they don't care. They're not going to buy, right? Or they're like here and they're, you know, they're thinking about like, what are the roadblocks now for me to adopt your product?
Yeah. Yeah. Where on this, if there's like a spectrum of where they're at, where are they in that whole spectrum of like, I don't care. I'm just in that first phase trying to get something up and running, trying to get leadership bought in. Or you're at the last phase of like, yeah, this has been a real thorn in my side for the last, I don't know how long, and I want to get it out of my side, and I'll do anything. Like, just tell me, what do I need to do, right?
Yeah.
And so I would love to see that blog post. Maybe we could put it on the MLOps community blog if you ever write it, because it does feel like something that would be quite valuable to everyone in the community and something that we've thought about a lot. You know, like, we always are philosophizing on maturity levels. And I think that is one thing that is quite interesting for people. I know we've had some awesome guests on here who have talked, like Maria and Basak came on here and they talked about, and they're from Marvelous MLOps. They talked about how they did an internal ML maturity study for their company, where they went around to all the different teams and they said, hey, we've got this form, fill it out, just to know, what are you using? How are you using it? How do you like it? What are you using for observability? Are you like, yes, no, maybe, this is the tool we're using. What are you using for orchestration? Here we go, boom, boom, boom. And then they were like, okay, well, if we're going to build something centralized, we're going to leverage what we already have that's already gone through procurement. Yep. And we already like are paying the credit card, right? And we've got it on whatever, some kind of retainer. Can we just up our usage of that or add it into the current centralized platform? So I thought that was a really nice way of doing it. And then they wrote a blog post on, here's all the questions we asked. Here's how we looked at the maturity of these different teams and how we thought about creating that centralized platform for our company. And so there's things like that, like maturity, especially as quickly as we're evolving and as quickly as the tooling is evolving, we still need to think about, like, what does maturity look like now in 2023 or 2024 versus, yeah, like maybe in 2020, it was like, has your team read the high interest credit card debt of machine learning? Have they read that paper? Whoa, you're super mature. Like, everybody's heard of that? Okay, cool. So now it's a whole different ballgame that we're in.
Yeah. So this hypothetical blog post, right, I think would be useful to both like orchestrator teams, like, or like ML product teams to figure out like to qualify their sales funnel, but also for organizations looking to buy solutions, right? So, and it's, you know, as much as I would like to just constantly be selling flight, right? It's sort of like leave it up to whatever like local conditions organization and like the team is subject to at a particular time, then like let them make the choice, right? If containerization is not super important, then like, right, there should be a roadmap for you to make those decisions. But you know, at the same time, I do think that there are just like some fundamental designs that will probably stand the test of time, and you know, I've kind of already mentioned them, right? But maybe an analogy would be like with programming languages, right? Like, we're learning the types are pretty good, you know? Like, having types in as a first-class feature in your programming language is like, maybe you do the way of Python or you add it on later, and it's not like really baked in properly or like really like fundamentally baked in. But like, there are some features in programming languages that are just really nice to have and, you know, just make us a lot more productive. And I think similar requirements and feature sets will come out for like the MLOps, LLMOps space.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that congregating around design and systems and like, okay, maybe there is, everyone's a special snowflake in some way or another, but there are certain things that are treated as first-class citizens. And you start to see that, and you start to realize that if I'm not treating these things as first-class citizens, then I'm going to make my life hard. And so potentially, that's like the second part of your blog post you're going to write. Like, what are the first-class citizens now? Like,
it'll be a challenge because I'll need to sort of do some more research and get out of my little flight bubble. And like,
some,
you know,
soul searching.
Do some soul searching. Yeah, exactly.
Dude, you know what I was thinking about? You know, I get the feeling you probably think like this, but living in like declarative worlds and seeing how easy that is when it comes to working with computers, do you notice you like try and do that in real life too? Before when you work with other people? It's like, hey, here's the, you know, like I'm just declaring what I want and you figure out how to go and do that.
That's interesting. I mean, when you say that, I can't kind of pinpoint a specific thing, but it does kind of jive with sort of one of my kind of values of sort of working with people, right? It's like, I don't like to be micromanaged. That is the imperative. Imperative programming is micromanaging the computer, right? Declarative flow programming, like really under the hood, there is some set of instructions that are carrying out your declaration, right? So it's maybe like a false, actual false binary. But anyway, when I'm working with people or I have a manager and we're trying to get stuff done, it's not like, here are all the steps. It's like, this is the outcome. This is the output. You know, do the thing yourself, figure it out, and, you know, execute it however you want. And yeah, I guess that's a very interesting actually point. I need to think about that more.
Sure. I just noticed it because in my life, I started trying to do it and I realized like how much more energy it is to try and break things down step by step. And then when you got to debug, like, why did this process not work out or what's going on here? It's just time consuming. Although you can offload parts of what you're trying to do, you still aren't necessarily able to just be like, here's what I want to happen. Now go make it happen. And that's where I think when you find someone that you can trust that will do that, that's an incredible boon.
Yep.
You know, it's just like, oh, sweet. Like, here's what I want to happen. And then I fully trust that you're going to be able to come back to me how over a certain amount of time, whether it's a week or a month or whatever, however big the project is. And you're going to be like, okay, so here's that outcome you were looking for. Here's how I did it. And maybe there's things along the way where you need that input from me, but it's not necessarily like I'm telling you how to do it. It's just like, hey, I've come to this crossroads and maybe you have some wisdom about how this should be done next. And so I'm really like realizing in my life, I'm trying to find more of that declarative person that I can work with so that I'm not going crazy and running around like a chicken with my head cut off on all these inputs like, oh, this is how it goes, like step one, step two, step three, step 300, you know?
Yeah. And I think the risk of that is that those instructions may not fit in someone else's head.
Yeah.
Right.
Or the edge cases, like just like in programming, you know, like if the same shit in real life where all of a sudden you think it's going to go one way. And then because I've done it, I have list of tasks, right, of things, procedures on how this podcast is going to work, right? And or maybe it's how we post a blog post on the MLOps community blog or these things where there's standard operating procedure. But then next thing you know, you've got somebody that maybe when they fill out the form that I sent you beforehand, they don't fill out certain parts of the form. And then, okay, well, what's that then? What's the edge case around that? How are we going to deal with that part of it? And so you have to go and figure out what you do there. And then next thing you know, oh, the guest doesn't show up, or the guest like shows up late or tries to reschedule. Okay, now we got to figure out, there's just so many different things that you have to work through. It's like, I don't want to have to work through each one of these edge cases. I just want to figure out, or I want to let you figure that out and trust that you're going to be able to figure it out.
Yeah. And maybe to bring it back to, you know, not to
flight
broach this topic too much, right? But this is like, you know, chain of thought. Like this is, there are like interesting mappings to like the LLM space here, right? Because when you give an instruction, you either expect the model to just get to the result immediately, or you have it kind of reason and try to like output more useful tokens for it in its context, its working memory, to like kind of help it in its task. And that's like the process of breaking things down, right? Like when you provide that declarative instruction, the person executing that instruction will still need to do things imperatively, like really at the end of the day. So, I mean, it's interesting that like we are creating these systems that are like simulacra, or like kind of simulate things that we can sort of relate to. And I think that's a big part of their power is our ability. They've kind of hacked us into like empathizing or like anthropomorphizing these systems that 100%. Are just token crunchers.
Yeah, really dumb autocomplete, as some say, or really smart autocomplete, as some would say.
Yeah.
Dude, well, this is awesome, man. You want a philosophical conversation? I think we went a little philosophical there at the end.
Yep. Yep.
That's it. I think we'll end it there. That's the pod, bro.
That's awesome. Thanks, Demetrius.
Hey everyone, my name is Aparna, founder of Arise, and the best way to stay up to date with MLOps is by subscribing to this podcast.